Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from the newsroom of PCJ Radio International. Well, last year's election campaign in the United States coined a new phrase which has become quite common, and that is fake news. Now, we have seen, of course, fake news for a number of years on the internet. I mean, you go on the internet, there are literally thousands and thousands of websites. Now, you may think that this is just an American phenomenon. Well, it isn't. It's also happening in Europe, where elections are taking place in France and the Netherlands, and also in Australia and the Pacific. Now, fake news and the post-24-hour media landscape is a fatal combination. How much fake news is skewing public conversation and who will ultimately be responsible? Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has criticized the elite media for neglecting the real concerns of the public. Now, does the Australian media need to heed a lesson from the US election that too much attention is given to polls and opinion? Well, some people might think so. Jonathan Green speaks next to Sabina Wolf. She's a media commentator. Miriam Robin is a media reporter with Crickety. And Catherine McGovern is a senior associate at The Agenda Group.
Fake news. This has been such a thing, and it was such a thing around the Trump campaign, notably, that the stuff that was carried on things like Facebook. I've got a little grab here. Listen up, this is the wonderful Milo Yiannopoulos being challenged on this idea of post-truth.
What does it say about Steve Bannon, who's now chief strategist, that you don't care about offending disabled people, ethnic minorities, women? You don't care about that.
I don't care about that. I care about facts. I don't care about your feelings.
But I thought you believed in a post-fact universe.
So who?
That's one of your quotes.
Is it? What's
we live in a post-fact era. It's wonderful, you said.
Yes, what I meant from that was just telling the facts are no longer enough. You now have to be persuasive and charismatic and interesting and funny.
The fun bit is that he might be the White House press secretary in the new administration.
Wouldn't that be absolutely terrifying?
This fake news thing, I mean, Catherine, you're in the business of communications. How easy is it to get people to swallow whatever it is you tell them?
That's a really great question. I think a lot of the time most people believe other people. It's their natural way of being, although I think we're seeing that change now. And because of this sort of thing, because of the internet, because of not having authoritative places to go to for news, people are getting much better at sifting through what doesn't make sense, what's offensive, what actually doesn't seem to logically add up. So I think people are getting better.
You think they're sifting it out? They're working out the fact from fiction?
I think a lot of people are. I think there are some people who don't and never will. But yeah, I think there are certainly people. I think a lot of people go look at some of this sort of stuff and go, really, that's just rubbish.
I mean, Miriam, it's been such a talking point in these last couple of weeks and post the US election. I mean, there was no end of stuff. We have all the fabulous examples of Macedonian news turning up on Facebook. And people actually, Catherine says we're sifting it, but people that would appear, quite credulous in pockets.
Well, I guess what this sort of reminds me of in a way is I grew up in Egypt where fake news is very, very common, partly because the media is repressed and so rumours go around about all of these atrocities that are being covered up by the government. And it's a sort of similar vibe here in that I feel that people don't trust the media, so they turn to fake news. It comes down to the lack of trust in the established media that large parts of the American population have at the moment.
And I guess fake news, Sabine, is not a thing which is likely to increase that sense of trust.
Well, no, that's true. But I think it's becoming more important to... I think we are in a bit of a transitionary period at the moment. It's becoming more important to have trusted, credible sources. But, you know, for the moment, while people figure out what those are, we're sort of in this post-fact space, I guess you could say. And I do think that people tend to, Facebook is a really good example of this. People tend to believe that people around them that they know are genuinely telling the truth. So, you know, I think the reason fake news was such a problem is because you had friends and family sharing these pieces on Facebook. And, you know, you try to believe that. So, I mean, I don't know where we're going to go, but I do think that it's more important than ever for a strong and robust media culture.
Well, and Miriam, this is your beat, and we're in this environment where the traditional hierarchies in media are collapsing, where, you know, we used to get our news from authoritative sources. It was edited, it was moderated, it came from places we trusted. Now it can come from anywhere. It is hard to pick.
It is, and a lot of the things that would go around Facebook, partly because people are sharing them, but also partly because the Facebook algorithm would serve up stories that would match what it perceived as your political views. Mm. A lot of them look really credible, and I've fallen for one or two fake articles that I've then you know, Googled yes. What is this website, and it's like, you know, I believed it for 5 minutes and then I've looked into it because it seems too extraordinary. But yeah. Like, you know, I guess that's my job. So I did put in the 5 minutes to look around, and usually someone's done it. This is a hoax article. But I mean, a really common one that I see all of these, you know, some journalists sharing on Twitter is a story about how Trump said that if he ever ran for president, he'd pick Republicans because they'll believe anything. And apparently this was an interview in Life that he gave. He never gave that interview. He never said the quote.
Hmm.
And this gets shared around as well.
Which is the other part of this, Catherine, that we all want to believe what we believe. So confirmation bias is such a huge part of this. And when you have, you know, sort of online social media silos and echo chambers being fed with their own fake version of facts, it's a weirdly sort of sustaining environment.
And I think it's really interesting because actually I think there are people who want to be challenged on their views and actually want to dig deeper, but there are huge numbers of internet algorithms, Facebook being a great example, as Miriam said, of actually people material being screened before it even hits you, of actually to your personal prejudices or biases, or even your search history. If you ever search something that you haven't searched before and you spend 5 minutes or 10 minutes doing that, some of the stuff that comes onto your system the next day actually just reflects that rather than anything else that you've been doing. And it does echo. It just keeps echoing.
Echoing and reinforcing and perpetuating. I mean, Sabine, you say it's sort of transitional, but that's, yeah, but where is it heading exactly?
I'm fully prepared to say I have no idea. Something I do think that we need to be wary of is, you know, you've seen a lot in the last few weeks, a lot of people talking about the need to censor fake news and reform Facebook's algorithms and things like that.
Well, take some responsibility for it, perhaps.
But I have a bit of a problem with that because you get into this very messy kind of area between fake news and satire, and the two are obviously incredibly different.
Oh, Breitbart.
I'm thinking more The Onion and Clickhole. Yes, the two are actually incredibly different, but, you know, who gets to decide what is real news and what is fake news? How do we tread the line carefully between satire, which I think
serves a very...
What do
you mean, who gets to decide what's true and what's fake? I mean, isn't that fairly self-evident? It's either true or it's not.
Yes, but who gets to decide whether or not the source is satire or fake news? And I think, you know, in that context, we do need to be a little bit careful because satire is, of course, itself its own incredibly important method of political discourse.
Are we just making category errors here, Miriam? Or is there a sort of, and this is something that's been thrown at Facebook in these last few days, this sort of absence of sort of curatorial responsibility for what's being put out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not that worried about taking out satire because I think that fake news is obviously often intending to deceive you, and that can often be quite obvious. I mean, on the whole curating thing, I'm a little bit hesitant to lay it all at Facebook's feet, partly because on the one hand, Facebook can do something about this, and maybe they should because it would be a good thing to do. But on the other hand, I don't know if you guys ever notice at the bottom of websites, you'll see things like Outbrain or Taboola, which are affiliate links that websites get money from. And this is on a lot of really major news websites, including Fairfax in Australia. And sometimes there's fake links in that as well. And the whole web ecosystem is built on attention, and Facebook is part of that, but so are news publishers. And I think that's the problem of how the internet is monetized at the moment.
I guess what it does point to, he said, blowing the corporation's own trumpet for a moment, is perhaps the value of a public broadcaster beyond commercial political influence. And yet, of course, we get accused of various things by all sorts of people. Here's the Prime Minister having a crack.
I often get on the elite media like the ABC. I would have thought after this last election in the United States, people might focus less on the polls and less on the opinions of commentators on the ABC or in other elite media outlets, and focus instead on what people are actually saying. The real issue, the real challenge for politicians, and dare I say it, journalists, is to actually get in touch with the people, listen to the people, focus on what the real concerns are.
This has been the great political
this
conversation
of our
time.
This is absolutely absurd coming from from a politician to say, oh, we need to focus on what the people are saying. Well, that's good, mate. How about you take that advice to heart and actually practice that? No, I get so frustrated with this.
He can't be an elitist. He catches public transport.
I also enjoy the pronunciation elite. That's a very elite pronunciation of elite. But, yeah, I mean, you know, for politicians to say the media are out of touch and, you know, they're not particularly listening to what, you know, people are saying when you have a government that is apparently bereft of an ideological agenda, a legislative agenda at the moment, I'm not sure. I think they might need to start at home. Look inwards towards yourselves.
Well, that's true. Why, I wonder, Catherine, does that have to be a media responsibility for media to you know, lead this process of communication with the greater public?
And I really don't think it is a media issue just alone. I mean, I think politicians start at home. Look at what's happened around the world this year with Brexit, with Trump and so forth, of people actually appearing not to be listening to what people actually say when they get to a polling booth. You've got to get to a polling booth before anybody actually listens to what's being said. Mm. So politicians need to take some of that on as well. And I'd agree entirely with Sabine. Go back to your base and actually think about what you're doing as a group before you start pointing fingers at everybody else.
And there's something, Miriam, isn't there to be said for a media which is a bit elitist? Especially in this area of conversation around fact and truth and inquiry, if that's an elite activity, well, kind of so be it.
Well, I mean, I think what he means is sort of, do you focus on bread and butter issues or do you focus on a culture war issue? And I think I do think there is something to what he's saying in the sense that who's been pushing this 18C thing? I feel like it's been the Australian newspaper.
You've got some fun facts on that, I think.
So, they've published since August, since that infamous Bill Leak cartoon that led to an 18C complaint now withdrawn, the Australian has published 135,000 words on 18C. That includes articles, letters, columns, editorials. So if you look at who's setting the agenda in Australia right now, I think it's the Australian newspaper. They're certainly doing a far better job than the politicians, and they're setting the agenda for the ABC as well.
And that cartoon, of course, had the distinction of being the last Bill Leak cartoon that anybody could understand.
Or the first in some time also. No, but you're entirely right, but that the Australian have been pushing 18C, but also there are certain sections of the Liberal Party, I'm thinking Mr. Bernardi perhaps, who have also been pushing this quite heavily. So, but, you know, it's incumbent, I think, on the rest of the Liberal Party to say, hang on a second, we know this is not what concerns mums and dads out in Parramatta or wherever.
Which they've been saying. I mean, Barnaby Joyce has been saying that this past week, as has Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, it's an interesting thing, though, Catherine. I mean, the right media have their set of concerns. Leftish progressive media have their own set of concerns, gay marriage, for example, notably, both of which could be argued are kind of out of touch with common sentiment and common interest. I mean, I wonder what's that disconnection is not healthy for media, I would have thought.
Well, it's what leads to Facebook allegedly being responsible for 50% of what Americans read in relation to the news, because they're actually switching off from those traditional forms of media and they're going to other forms of media which are actually not necessarily any more authoritative, in many cases much less authoritative, but are actually potentially talking about what they want to hear.
The ABC's Jonathan Green was speaking there to Sabina Wolfe, a media commentator, Miriam Robin, a media reporter at Crickety, and Catherine McGovern, a senior associate at The Agenda Group. You're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. A story that we focused on last week's edition of the program is about Fiji deporting an Iranian refugee. Now, Fiji is defending its decision to forcibly deport an asylum seeker from Iran amid accusations that it has bungled an important human rights opportunity. Longman Safari left Port Moresby on a false passport almost 2 weeks ago, but was taken by Fiji police on Friday as he traveled with his lawyer to meet immigration officials to apply for asylum. A 21-year-old from Iran was detained on Manus Island by Australia at the age of 17. Amelia Lanford reports.
Lokman Sawari and his lawyer, Aman Ravindra Singh, were on their way to meet with Fiji's Director of Immigration in Suva last week when their vehicle was intercepted by police. Mr. Ravindra Singh says the police were very aggressive and bundled Mr. Sawari into a car before putting his client on a plane back to PNG. He says he's very worried about his client's safety.
I fear for his life now.
You fear for his life? Why do you say that?
Yes, because he had fled a few life-threatening situations from PNG. He had been threatened, he had been beaten up, he was living in daily fear. Now what the government has done is returned him from the very place he had fled.
Mr. Ravindra Singh says Fiji clearly has no respect for human rights at any level.
This is the same government which harps on about respecting human rights and giving its people full democracy, which is an utter joke. And it also shows the deception used by the Director of Immigration in luring us to Suva and assuring us that everything was in place, yet colluding with the police officer and the Attorney General of Fiji, who was the mastermind of this whole plot.
Mr. Sawari had earlier told us that he found PNG very dangerous and he felt unsafe living in Leh, which is PNG's second largest city. He says immigration authorities wouldn't let him go back to Manus Island to live with the other asylum seekers.
The more than two times I saw the rush call, they coming to stealing something from other people. And I complained to immigration. I told them, if it's not safe, why you bring me here? I need security. I cannot stay here because it's not safe for me.
However, Fiji's Attorney General has defended deporting Mr. Sawari, saying PNG authorities informed him that Mr. Sawari was travelling on a fake passport. In a written statement, Ayaz Syed Kayum says Mr. Sawari is recognised as a refugee by PNG and Fiji has merely returned him to his rightful place of residence.
Sawari eluded the authorities during his 10 days in Fiji while posting photographs of himself on social media at various locations. Under international law, anyone who is seeking political asylum is required to lodge an application without delay. In the case of Sawari, this did not happen.
But Amnesty International says Fiji has bungled an opportunity to improve its human rights record. Its Pacific researcher Kate Schutze says Fiji has failed an important test at a time when it's making a bid for a seat on the UN's Human Rights Council.
The Fijian authorities gave assurances that he would not be arrested before he had that interview. He's been let down quite seriously by those promises, and I think serious questions need to be asked because this is a pretty big bungle by Fiji.
Kate Schutze says Mr. Lokman came to Fiji seeking protection and was entitled to a fair assessment of his claim. Meanwhile, the PNG government has told Fairfax that tendering false statements as part of an application for a passport or travel document is a criminal offence. It says breaches will be investigated and those breaking the law will be prosecuted. And Australia's Department of Immigration and Border Protection has offered no comment except to say the settlement of refugees in PNG is a matter for the PNG government. This is Amelia Langford.
Transparency International PNG says reports 9 Papua New Guinea Defence Department civilian staff have been sacked should be a concern to everyone in the country. The sackings come at a time as the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, has suspended 2 cabinet ministers who are accused of fraud over a land deal for a new military base near Port Moresby. Don Wiseman asked Transparency International's PNG's chairman, Lawrence Steffens, what is known about the justifications for the sacking the workers.
The only details we had were the details which were published in the paper, and we reacted to that. As we understand it, they complained to the Public Service Department about extraordinary and incorrect things taking place in the Defence Department, and as we read it, they were therefore sacked.
Transparency International, you've got a very strong view about this. What do you think should have happened?
Our view is that public servants are obliged to report things that are wrong, behaviour that is wrong. We have far too many people who are led to believe they have to keep their mouths shut because it's an official secret or some nonsense like that. Whereas, in fact, people know that things are being done badly and they should be encouraged to make sure that these are brought into the open so that they can be attended to, not punished when they do so.
Of course, jobs can be hard to come by in the public service in Papua New Guinea, so people are under that constant pressure. Your organisation, you've got this advocacy and legal advice centre. What exactly are you offering potential whistleblowers?
We're offering anybody who is witness to or suffers from corruption the opportunity to come in, discuss or contact us, not even come in if they don't wish, contact us and discuss the situation they're facing and to think through with them the best ways of addressing that. It's, as you point out, it's difficult. Jobs are hard to come by in Papua New Guinea and people are often fearful for their jobs. In fact, many companies are fearful for their contracts and so keep quiet as well. But we aim to encourage people to shine a light in these dark, murky areas and assist them face the problems that they're facing and have them addressed, not simply hide from them.
Now, as you say, you don't know the details of these particular allegations. If they were talking about misadministration and whatever within the Defence Department, is it likely, in your view, to be incompetence or corruption?
Again, without talking to the people involved, I can't say for sure, but if one looks at the front pages of the two newspapers today, it's fairly clear that the Prime Minister thinks that the Defence Department has been riddled with corrupt behaviour, with the land deals that are involving two ministers. One can imagine that there is corruption in that department. Otherwise, those brave people would not have come forward. And we feel that those people should be honoured, not made to suffer for it. As for what is going on within the Defence Department, we're now being told there'll be an inquiry. We look forward to hearing results from that inquiry. And it would be very refreshing to hear that an inquiry which takes place actually comes to conclusions which people respond to by taking action.
Transparency International's PNG's chairman, Lawrence Stephan, speaking there with Don Wiseman. The Pacific Islands are being tipped as a perfect rugby Stevens host if the plug is pulled on the struggling Wellington tournament. New Zealand Rugby has 2 years to run on its contract with World Rugby, but it's struggling to get 10,000 people each day into Westpac Stadium. After 18 years of Wellington playing host, there's fresh calls to take the tournament to Fiji, the home of the Rugby Stevens Olympic Championships. Eric Peralta has more.
Some say they're glad to see the demise of the event that unleashed hordes of drunken people through Wellington, while others say the fun police have killed it off with alcohol restrictions. The NZR General Manager of Relationships, Planning and Operations, Nigel Cass, says the tournament has been arguably the world's most successful, but it's not as fresh as it once was.
We have tried to cater for the people who want to go and party, but also alongside that provide opportunities for people who may be a little more committed to watching the rugby and those with families. But clearly that hasn't met the market. You know, we haven't achieved the crowds that we wanted to achieve.
Nigel Cass says nothing is ruled in or ruled out, and the review will start to look at a different venue. While Dunedin Mayor Dave Cull put in a pitch to host the event, Mr. Cass says World Rugby would be concerned about choosing an iconic city to match other hosts on the circuit, like Dubai, Las Vegas and Hong Kong. But if NZR was to end the relationship, there's others nearby who are ready to take the ball and run. That's the Fiji Sevens rugby team singing after their loss to South Africa in Wellington. The Olympic champions have longed for years to host their own tournament. Former New Zealand Sevens coach and the new coach of Samoa, Gordon Teachins, says now's the time to take it to the islands.
It'd be a great tournament in Apia and Samoa. I mean, we saw the success of the All Black 15-a-side game when they played Manu Samoa.
you know, just last year. And of course, if a seventh tournament went to Apia, it would be a sellout. If it went to Fiji, it would also be a sellout.
The CEO of Fiji's Port Dinarao Marina in Nandi, Nigel Skeggs, says it's been a long-term vision to build a 20,000-capacity stadium at the famous tourist hub, but talks with landowners have been stalled. He says the logistics need to be worked out well, but Fiji is ready for it.
There's always talk of Fiji being involved in the Super 15. We've got other international tournaments we'd be interested in as well. So it's all about developing the sport in Fiji and being recognised that Fiji is as the world champions and the Olympic champions. But I think we deserve a shot to be able to host an event such as this.
But in 2014, World Rugby thought it was too soon, knocking back a bid from the Fiji Rugby Union to play host in the 2015-16 season. The president of the Fiji Hotels and Tourism Association, Dixon Sito, says when Fiji hosted a Super Rugby game last year in Suva at the 19,000-capacity ANZ Stadium, accommodation was a problem, with some players and fans having to travel some distance to the game. Mr. Sito says if the stadium can be built in Nandi, the timing of the Wellington Sevens tournament suits Fiji well and could help its off-peak tourism season.
What we are trying to do in the tourism side is to encourage more traffic during the trough periods, and this would help in that respect. So as we schedule sporting events, we would definitely schedule it during the weaker months, because you don't want sort of pressure on accommodation when we're in the peak tourism season, you know.
Dixon Sito says he used to attend the event in Wellington, and although it's a pity it's on the way out, it only makes a stronger case for Fiji to take it on. This is Alex Perrottet.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from the studios of PCJ Radio International. There's also a three-time daily edition that radio stations in the Pacific get on FM. To find out what stations they are, just visit our website, pcjmedia.com, or visit our Facebook page just do a search for PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you, especially listeners who are tuning in through the World Radio Network. Focus at pcjmedia.com. That's focus at pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until then, so long, and take care. Bye-bye.